TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
We were told to go electric because it is safe, clean, and inexpensive. Now campaigns across the world demand to keep nuclear power and coal and gas plants open. A controversy between Helen Caldicott and Australian opposition leader Peter Dutton. He campaigns for 7 new nuclear reactors. Here's his announcement on June 18, 2024, broadcast on Sky News Australia.
Okay, everyone, thank you very much for being here today. I'm very pleased to be joined by my colleagues because this is a major announcement. The future of our country is incredibly important, and we need to have a plan for the economy, we need to have a plan for jobs, and we need to have a plan for cheaper electricity. There is a greater likelihood of blackouts and brownouts. We know that the government has a renewables-only policy which is just not fit for purpose. No other country in the world can keep the lights on 24/7 with the renewables-only policy. We need to make sure that hospitals can stay on 24/7. We need to make sure that cold rooms can stay on 24/7. We need to make sure that our economy can function 24/7, and we can only do that with a strong baseload power. And today we announce 7 locations that we have looked at in great detail over a long period of time that can host new nuclear sites, and that will be part of an energy mix, obviously with renewables and significant amounts of gas into the system, particularly in the interim period. It will mean that on those end-of-life coal-fired power station sites, we can utilise the existing distribution network. This is a really important point. Labor has promised 28,000 kilometres of new poles and wires. There's no transparency about where that will go, and we've been very clear about the fact that we don't believe in that model. We want to utilise the existing assets that we've got, and the poles and wires that are used at the moment on the coal-fired power station sites can be utilised to distribute the energy generated from the latest generation nuclear reactors. We have the ability to do that in a way that that renewables can't. I want to make sure that the Australian public understands today that we have a vision for our country to deliver cleaner electricity, cheaper electricity, and consistent electricity. There's no sense pretending that our economy can operate without a stable energy system. And our plan today, which will include these 7 sites, is integral to the energy roadmap for our country into the future. The assets will be owned by the Commonwealth, a very important point, and we'll work with experts to deliver these programs. I'm going to ask DLP to David to say a few words. The other colleagues will speak, and then I'm happy to take questions from there.
Well, thanks, Dutto. It's a proud day to be the Nationals leader. This has been a long-held view of the National Party, but it's prouder for me to stand here with my coalition friends, led by Peter Dutton, who's had the courage of the conviction to come forward, to stand forward and show a different way for Australia. That takes leadership and strength in leadership and a vision for our country where Australians will once again own some of their generation of power in this country, a vision for manufacturing in this country that'll underpin it with the fundamentals of 24/7 power. It's about a vision for regional Australia, one that isn't covered in solar panels and wind turbines and transmission lines. It's one that gives them hope that they can continue to give you the food security that you enjoy every day and continue to try and keep your food prices down. It's a vision for the men and women who are in our coal-fired power stations across our country. This is a vision and a belief in them that they're part in our Australian economy and what they have made for us, that they're still part of that. When all seems lost, it's now time for strength in leadership. It's time for the coalition to take over and to lead our nation away from this madness of an all renewables approach, if you give us that chance. So thanks, Dutto.
Thank you. Thank you. Susan.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for your clear-eyed and consistent leadership on an issue that is so vital for the future of our country, for our children and our grandchildren. How can this Prime Minister promise a future made in Australia when he can't keep the lights on today? in order to have that future made in Australia, we have to have nuclear energy in the mix. But the latest generation nuclear technology used by 19 of the 20 biggest economies will give us longer, long-term, lower power prices. Our nuclear plan will put our country back on track. This is a plan for all of you, for cheaper energy, for an optimistic future, and for the future to really, really be made in Australia.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, colleagues. Labor is turning the lights out. Prices will soar, jobs will be shed, and industries will collapse. Australians will be left poorer and our nation weaker. All this and emissions have flatlined. In fact, our local environment is being severely damaged. But it's only going to get worse, and this is a direct consequence of Labor putting all its eggs in one basket with a renewables-only policy. Gas is being suffocated with a lack of supply. And we have 90% of Australia's 24/7 baseload power exiting the grid over the next decade, with no chance of a replacement being ready in time. Labor is turning off one system before having another one ready to go. Australia's running out of energy. Now, only the Coalition has the ability to get Australia back on track. And our plan is to deliver cheaper, cleaner, and consistent 24/7 electricity as part of a balanced energy mix. Today, we have renewables, we have gas, and we have coal. As we move forward into the future, we see an Australia that will still have a balanced mix of technologies. Renewables, gas, and as coal retires from the system, it will be replaced with zero emissions nuclear energy. This is the natural next step for us as a nuclear nation. Australia already is a nuclear nation. Through the AUKUS deal with the United States and the United Kingdom, Australia will have nuclear-propelled submarines. And we know that nuclear technology also underpins livelihoods. As a country with the largest reserves of uranium, powering nuclear plants the world over, despite having none of our own, we know the economic importance of nuclear technology. And so today we go that one step further as a coalition under Peter Dutton's leadership to spell out what our plan is to introduce a civil nuclear program into Australia. This represents a new era of economic prosperity for Australia, a new era underpinned by an abundance of cheap, clean and consistent 24/7 electricity. Thanks very much.
That was the Australian opposition leader Peter Dutton with his shadow cabinet, dropping the bombshell of making the upcoming elections in Australia a referendum on nuclear power plant construction. One day later, ABC News Australia broadcast an interview with David Spears under the title Peter Dutton and the Seven Nuclear Reactors.
ABC Listen.
It's a big gamble, but will it pay off? Peter Dutton is going all in on nuclear energy, announcing seven sites for reactors and setting the stage for an energy referendum at the next election. The choice for voters, do you want a renewable future or a nuclear one? Today, the ABC's national political lead and Insider's host, David Spears, on what will be one of the biggest policy debates of our time. I'm Sam Hawley on Gadigal Land in Sydney. This is ABC News Daily.
Today we announce seven locations that we have looked at in great detail over a long period of time that can host new nuclear sites. We have a vision for our country to deliver cleaner electricity, cheaper electricity and consistent electricity.
It's about a vision for regional Australia, one that isn't covered in solar panels and wind turbines and transmission lines.
Our nuclear plan will put our country back on track.
Spezi, if you thought the coalition wasn't actually serious about nuclear, you were wrong, right?
Yeah, look, they are deadly serious about this, and they've been talking it up for months and months that the policy announcement would come. Now it's come, at least in part. We don't yet have the cost of all of this. We'll come to that, but we do have the locations. Even just giving these locations and making the commitment they've made is a big political gamble. Now Peter Dutton is saying he'll go to the election with a nuclear policy plan.
All right, so this is a big announcement from Peter Dutton, and it will be a huge part of the battle at the next election, clearly. Just tell me then, what did he say? Where are these seven nuclear reactors going to be if, of course, the coalition wins the election?
So they're all on the sites of retiring coal-fired power plants. And remember that 90% of our coal fleet is due to go in the next decade. The idea, as I say, is to simply use that existing infrastructure to build a nuclear plant so that you can plug it straight into the network.
So when are they going to be built, did he say?
Good question. So the first two he expects would come between 2035 and 2037. The rest wouldn't come until the 2040s. The idea here is to have them all up and running so that we can still hit net zero by 2050. But of course, what it would mean for emissions in the meantime is very unclear. The coalition is not going to be taking any interim emissions targets to the election, nor is it clear what the cost of all of this would be. But those first two could be either large or small scale reactors.
As you mentioned, Spizzy, they haven't said how much this is actually going to cost, but we do know it's wildly expensive, right, to build a nuclear reactor.
Yeah.
Massively expensive.
Expensive to build and expensive in terms of the power that's generated, according to the CSIRO. Last month, the CSIRO and the energy market operator released their Gen Cost report, most detailed research really into what this would cost, the nuclear option. And it found large scale, fair bit cheaper than the small modular reactors, but even the large scale reactors would cost about $17 billion for the first one and then about $8 billion for each one after that. The power generated would be about double the cost of renewables backed by firming, and that is pumped hydro batteries and so on. So renewables with firming, still half the price of what nuclear power would be. So look, if you start now and you don't get one of these nuclear plants at the earliest for another 10 or 12 years and the full fleet for another 20 or so years, what happens in the meantime? What are we relying on, and what does that mean for our power prices? Now, Peter Dutton wants to string out as long as possible the existing coal-fired plants and use a lot more gas. But given the aging fleet that we're talking about and the price of gas, again, it's unknown whether it would be any cheaper. He says it would, but we just don't have that detail.
And as you say, we were debating this 20 years ago. The coalition was debating whether or not it was a good idea. And then, of course, in 1998, John Howard actually banned nuclear power. So it's not even legal here. You know, that would have to change too.
That's the first big hurdle. It was John Howard who did that deal with the Greens, in fact, to put a ban on nuclear power. But yeah, removing that ban would have to be the first thing a Dutton coalition government would have to do. Then you've got the states who have their own bans in place, and the states are all opposed to what he's talking about at the moment as well. So a lot of hurdles to overcome.
It says, of course, that it threatens our green transition.
Well, it certainly does threaten the transition to renewables, the path that we're on, because, yes, Peter Dutton is saying he'd prefer to keep those coal-fired power plants running much longer, use more gas as well, and clearly there's hostility towards these big renewable projects in the regions from the Nationals and from the Liberals. Look, there are obviously difficulties in this energy transition, no doubt about it, and yes, energy prices have risen, and Peter Dutton is really tapping into those concerns about costs, about the impact on the regions of all the transmission lines required for wind and solar projects as well. And that's why he's saying the much simpler solution is this nuclear idea.
This is, isn't it, the climate wars back with a vengeance?
Yeah, and in fact, Peter Dutton, he said that he's happy to have a referendum at the election on energy and nuclear. Polls have shown growing support for nuclear power. There was a Lowy Institute poll only a couple of weeks ago, which had supported about 61%. Mm. So the principal idea of nuclear isn't proving to be a turnoff, according to the data we've seen so far. Now that we move into a more informed debate about what the coalition are planning, perhaps the polling will be more relevant, will tell us a little more about how Australians feel, particularly in some of those local communities as well, where there's so far been a mixed reaction to the idea of having a nuclear plant down the road.
That was an interview with ABC Australia's David Spears on the bombshell just dropped the day before. Opposition leader Peter Dutton announced 7 sites for new nuclear reactors and opened up on the biggest Australian policy debate of our time. Only 3 days later, on June 22nd, the Australian anti-nuclear campaigner Helen Caldicott joined the debate with a line of reasoning that nobody had yet mentioned: safety. Helen Caldicott is best known for having founded several associations dedicated to opposing the use of nuclear power, depleted uranium munitions, and nuclear weapons. She studied and later taught pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. In the 1970s, she gained prominence in Australia, New Zealand, and North America, speaking on the health hazards of radiation. She also informed Australian trade unions about the medical and military dangers of uranium mining. That led to the 3-year banning of the mining and export of uranium. After the Fukushima Daiichi explosions in Japan that began on March 11, 2011, she began a several-year-long campaign calling out the dangers of nuclear power plants.
It's an absolute lie to say that nuclear power does not produce CO2. Nuclear power causes global warming in its own right to a large extent. Nuclear power plant does not stand alone. It's supported by a huge industrial infrastructure, mining millions of tons of earth and rock and uranium. Enriching uranium takes 2 huge coal-fired plants to enrich uranium in America, where our uranium is enriched. And also a huge amount of CFC gas is released from that plant. 93% of the CFC-114 gas, which is the most ubiquitous, is released in America from that uranium enrichment plant. And CFC gas is 10 to 20,000 times more potent as a global warmer than CO2. And CFCs are banned under the Montreal Protocol because they destroy the ozone layer, as well as being global warming gases. But the nuclear industry has been grandfathered out of the Montreal Protocol. To build a reactor requires a huge amount of concrete. Production of concrete releases huge amounts of CO2. And then decommissioning a reactor, a big one's never been decommissioned, requires huge amounts of fossil fuel and robots to take it apart and the like. And keeping it cool for decades with circulating water, more electricity, more coal fire plants. And then there's the transportation and storage of radioactive waste for the next million years. So it's an absolute lie and a promulgation of a myth to say that nuclear power does not produce CO2.
On June 22nd, 2024, Helen Caldicott sent an email to friends and organizations, quoting from the introduction to her book, Crisis Without End. It's a collection of talks by the world's leading scientific and medical experts on the long-term health and environmental consequences of the Fukushima nuclear accident. The Helen Caldicott Foundation and Physicians for Social Responsibility co-sponsored the event at the prestigious New York Academy of Medicine. The gathering was a response to widespread concern that the media and policymakers had been far too eager to move past what are clearly deep and lasting impacts for the Japanese people and for the world. This was the first comprehensive attempt to address the health and environmental damage done by one of the worst nuclear accidents of our times. I'm now reading from the introduction to Crisis Without End that Helen Caldicott mailed out in response to the campaign launched by opposition leader Peter Dutton to bring back nuclear power in Australia. And she begins in first person. Because I was so worried about the ignorance of the world's media and politicians about radiation biology after the dreadful accident at Fukushima in Japan, I organized a two-day symposium at the New York Academy of Medicine on March 11 and 12, 2013, titled The Medical and Ecological Consequences of Fukushima. It was addressed by some of the world's leading scientists, epidemiologists, physicists, and physicians. They presented their latest data and findings on Fukushima. I hoped to attract the global media to educate them. Background. The Great Eastern Earthquake and massive tsunami on the east coast of Japan caused the meltdown of three nuclear reactors within several days and four hydrogen explosions in buildings 1, 2, 3, and 4. Fukushima is now described as the greatest industrial accident in history. Massive quantities of radiation escaped into the air and water from these damaged reactors. Three times more noble gases, argon, xenon, and krypton, than were released at Chernobyl, together with huge amounts of other radioactive elements, such as cesium, strontium, tritium, iodine, plutonium, etc. Unfortunately, the people of Japan were not notified of the meltdowns for 3 months, because the government did not want to create panic. A typical 1,000-megawatt nuclear reactor contains as much radiation as that released by the explosions of 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs, and the fissioned uranium becomes 1 billion times more radioactive than the original uranium because more than 200 intensely radioactive elements have been created, whose half-lives range from seconds to millions of years. So concerned was the Japanese government, according to the then Prime Minister Naoto Kan, that they were considering plans to evacuate 35 million people from Tokyo, because other reactors, including Fukushima Daiichi on the east coast, were also at risk. Thousands of people fleeing from the smoldering reactors were not notified where the radioactive plumes were traveling, despite the fact that the Japanese government and the U.S. were tracking the radioactive plumes. So people fled directly into the path of the highest radiation concentrations, where they were exposed to high levels of whole-body external gamma radiation. Nor were these people supplied with inert potassium iodide, which would have blocked the uptake of deadly radioactive iodine by their thyroid glands, except in the town of Miharu. However, prophylactic iodine was given to the staff of Fukushima Medical University in the days after the accident, after extremely high levels of radioactive iodine, 1.9 million becquerels per kilogram, were found in leafy vegetables near the university. This contamination was widespread in vegetables, fruit, meat, milk, rice, and tea in many areas of Japan. The Fukushima meltdown disaster is not over and will never end. The radioactive fallout, which remains toxic for hundreds to thousands of years, will never be cleaned up and will contaminate food, humans, and animals virtually forever. The three reactors, which experienced total meltdown, I predict, says Helen Caldicott, will never be disassembled or decommissioned. And even TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, says it will take at least 30 to 40 years. And the International Atomic Energy Agency predicts more than 40 years before they can make any progress because of the enormous levels of radiation at these damaged reactors. The amount of radioactive water that has already been discharged into the Pacific is far greater than that released to the sea by Chernobyl. Fish caught out as far as 100 kilometers from Fukushima are radioactive, and tuna caught off the coast of California are already contaminated by cesium-134 and 137 from Fukushima. Tritium is radioactive hydrogen, H3, and there's no way to separate tritium from contaminated water. It is a soft beta emitter and a potent carcinogen, and remains radioactive for more than 100 years. It concentrates in aquatic organisms, including algae, seaweed, and fish. Because it is tasteless, odorless, and invisible, it will inevitably be ingested in food, including seafood, for many decades. It combines in the DNA molecule, the gene, where it can induce mutations that later lead to cancer. It causes brain tumors, birth deformities, and cancer of many organs. I was reading excerpts from Helen Caldicott's introduction to the book she edited, Crisis Without End, published in 2014. Crisis Without End takes an unprecedented look into the profound aftereffects of Fukushima. Leading experts from Japan, the United States, Russia, and other nations weigh in on radiation-related health risks, impacts on the world's oceans, the question of low-dosage radiation risks, crucial comparisons with Chernobyl, health and environmental impacts on the United States, and the unavoidable implications for the nuclear energy industry. However, now it seems as if the safety risks of nuclear power are forgotten or being pushed aside in the global effort to bring back nuclear power stations. Meanwhile, you can follow and contribute to the debate on nuclear safety up to the next Australian federal election on or before September 27, 2025. Come back when TUC Radio returns for excerpts from the two-day symposium at the New York Academy of Medicine in March 2013, titled The Medical and Ecological Consequences of Fukushima. The excerpts are from the archives of TUC Radio. I produced a 10-part series right after the end of the symposium. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.